If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. First of all, it's free, which for us is really important. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and more. You can make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership, and it's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Emergency Docs. I'm Dr. R. Please note that the content of this episode does not constitute medical advice, but is purely for the purpose of education. This episode was supported by the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists. Today, we're talking to Dr. Darren Toll. Dr. Toll is a LA native, born and raised in Santa Monica, California. She graduated from Georgetown University with a degree in biology and public health. She continued her studies at Georgetown School of Medicine before returning to California to attend UC Irvine Medical Center for residency training. She was selected as chief resident in her final year and won an award for excellence in pediatric emergency medicine. She enjoys skiing, wine tasting, and running in her spare time. So welcome, Dr. Toll.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So nice to have you. So tell me a little bit about your background. So you grew up in this area, but tell me about your childhood.
So I grew up in Santa Monica, which is in West LA. And I am one of three girls. I'm the middle daughter. Ended up going to an all-girls high school and then ended up going to Georgetown for college. Eventually came back to Los Angeles, lived with my parents for a year, which most millennials do anyway. I kind of was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, applied to med school, got back into Georgetown, and I knew I loved it for undergrad. So I went back for med school, came back because I love California and you can't beat the weather.
You really can't.
Yeah. And here I am today. So I am the only physician in my family. There's literally nobody in science, medicine, nothing. It's lawyers and business people. So
me too. I can totally empathize with that.
Forging our own paths, you know, nobody in our family is really telling us how to do or what to do. Figured it out along the way.
Most of the advice is like bad advice too, where they're like, oh no, you don't have to do that internship. And I'm like, really? I'm pretty sure I was supposed to do that.
Why are you so stressed? It'll all work out. Well, have you seen the admission rates for medical school?
They're like, just take the day off, take the summer off. I'm like, I don't think we're having the same conversation right now.
Studying for step one. Are you sure you have to wake up at 7 a.m. every day for 4 weeks?
Yeah. And then study until like 2 in the morning. It was intense.
Yeah. So that's me in a brief moment, basically.
So when did you know that you wanted to be a doctor? What inspired you to become a doctor?
There's two things that kind of, when I think about how and when I wanted to become a doctor. First is the first time I got hurt, which was when I was in fifth grade and I was playing soccer and I broke my arm. I know, it was terrible. My arm was crooked and all this stuff. We ended up in an ER and I will never forget the ER doctor setting my arm. I had no pain. And that was the first time I was like, whoa, this is a cool job. It felt so magical. And it was the first time that I'd really been in a hospital setting. And then I would say that in general, that's when I knew that I wanted to be a doctor. I mean, you know, you say that when you're young, you have very little to go off of. But as I got older, I would say there wasn't anything in particular that pushed me towards medicine, but I would say it was a couple of people who pushed me towards medicine. It was two of my doctors growing up, my pediatrician and my OBGYN. My pediatrician was Dr. Wasson. He was the funniest guy. He always had tricks up his sleeve. He made you laugh. He made you feel comfortable. He didn't say anything that ever make you not want to come back. I loved going to the pediatrician, which is so rare, I think, for kids. But everyone who went to Dr. Wasson loved him. And so I think that he exposed me to how fun and nice the medical world could be. And then my OBGYN was someone who I started going to, I don't know, 15, 16. And she's just one of the most kind-hearted people and really embodies what a physician is, where she cares about the whole person, the whole body, the mind, everything. And I thought to myself, I want to be like her. And I was like, so I'm going to be a doctor.
That's so cool. I love that you had, especially, I mean, that you had multiple doctors that were sort of just your personal doctors growing up that really helped influence your life that much. And I forget often that we have the potential to have those interactions and make that impact on kids. So that's a really cool, really cool story. Once you decided you wanted to go into medicine, how did you end up in emergency medicine?
I think like every other medical student going down the list, and you're a little bit in awe of the, I want to say, blingy specialties, you know, plastics, orthopedics. And I was definitely interested in those kinds of things. But what I loved about emergency was that you always were able to do something. Person comes in, they've got a broken arm, like when I was in fifth grade, I can do something about it. I can splint it, I can reduce it, I can splint it, they're okay. Someone comes in with a heart attack, I can start heparin, I can give them nitro, I can get them to the cath lab, I can do something. And then I will never forget that there was this one time when I was in medical school and they asked for a doctor on board. And there was a dermatologist, and the dermatologist was like the nicest person. He was very obviously a fish out of water. And I was like, wow, now I want to be the person that if they call for a physician, that I know what to do. I think in EM, you know, that's the saying, I'm sure everyone says this, the jack of all trades, master of none. I really think the master of none part is just silly, because we are masters of doing things, bringing people back to life, fixing things immediately, resuscitating, etc. So that's kind of what pushed me to emergency medicine. I love procedures, so that's always really fun. And then I just love seeing all walks of life. If I only had to see kids or only had to see adults or only see pregnant women, I think that just based on my personality, I would get a little bored.
That actually just reminded me of one of the reasons, or one of the first thoughts that I had about getting into medicine that I hadn't thought about in forever. And I remember that feeling of not being able to do something in a medical situation. And I was studying abroad in Kenya and seeing patients in an HIV clinic. And I just felt like, as a student taking blood pressures, that I couldn't do anything. And I wanted to be able to actually help and actually make a difference. That was just came back to me in this moment. One of the first things where I started thinking, hey, maybe medicine might be an interesting field to pursue. But like you said, a great thing about emergency medicine is there's almost any situation where we can figure out something to do, even if it means calling a referral. But we can, in most situations, figure out like what needs to be done next. And I agree. I love that about emergency medicine.
I love to be surrounded by emergency medicine physicians too, because I'm like, well, if something goes wrong, one of us will be able to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I remember I think it was my first rotation in residency, some of the internal medicine residents I was working with said, so you're an emergency medicine resident? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, do you drive a Jeep? Because like the impression that all emergency medicine physicians drive a Jeep, apparently. I was like, well, not now, but I used to have one. So stereotyped fit right there. Do you have one favorite thing about emergency medicine, or one thing that you love about it the most?
I already touched on this, but the variety, seeing all walks of life, and then also the procedures. I would say one of my favorite things is the central line. I love putting in a central line. So fun. I don't know, something about it so satisfying.
I feel very similarly, like doing a central line, it feels again, like you're doing something.
Yeah. When you have that crashing patient who needs 3 different pressors and antibiotics and you're just running out of excess and you put that central line and you are a hero.
Do you have a least favorite thing about emergency medicine?
So I'll talk a little bit about where I work so that you could kind of understand where I'm coming from. Well, the first thing that I want to say is my least favorite is the consultants. Sometimes you just get consultants who are just straight up mean, which I don't blame them because you're calling them in the middle of the night about something that they don't think is that important, but we understand how important it is. And you've got the patient right in front of you, the consultants in bed or wherever they are. And sometimes they're really nice, but most of the time they're not. And they don't understand where we're coming from, which is, I think, one of the more frustrating parts of the job. But my second least favorite part is, so one of the hospitals that I work at is, it's a community hospital. So they don't really have that many specialties in-house, but they have a couple of sister hospitals that they can transfer to. Part of transfer processes is going through insurance and trying to figure out which insurance is covered at which hospital and how to transfer the patients. And it becomes phone call after phone call after phone call to get an accepting physician, to get insurance to accept it, to even find a physician who accepts it on the other side. All of those things combined and rolled up into one, you end up spending hours trying to transfer a patient who, you know, has an open jaw fracture. You're like, well, they can't stay here. So that's a pretty frustrating part because we understand the urgency as ER physicians because we're sitting and looking at the patient. We know all the things that could go wrong if we don't get them the right care, but the urgency doesn't exist on the other side because it's a lot more business and protocol driven, which is frustrating.
I hear that from people a lot, and I completely agree. It can be so difficult dealing with some of the like more bureaucratic aspects of what we do. And I think a lot of times, you know, we'll spend 5 or 10 minutes with a patient and then spend an hour and a half making phone calls on behalf of that patient. And you walk in and see them again, and then they're like, why has it been so long since you've seen me, doc? And it's just kind of like, well, I've been on the phone with about 400 people trying to figure out what we need to do for your case. I wish that was something that patients could understand and see, is just how much time we are really spending on trying to get them the right care. And I know that's not always apparent.
It's definitely not always apparent. And half the time you spend all of that energy trying to do the right thing for the patient, finding the right consultant, finding the right place for them. And then they're mad because they've been sitting there for 4 hours and they decide to leave against medical advice.
Yes. Yes. Like, please stay, please. So do you have a memorable case that you can discuss anonymously that might have a good teaching point?
I have a pretty good case. This was at the very beginning of when we were attending. So maybe November after we graduated. So maybe 4 or 5 months after graduating from residency, I had a patient who came in with chest pain radiating to his back, history of hypertension, diabetes, and a kidney transplant. Obviously, any emergency physician who hears chest pain radiating to the back gets concerned about a dissection. So I think to myself, okay, maybe it's a dissection, but they're so rare. I mean, in residency, I think maybe I saw one. I mean, it's so rare, but let's just get some blood work and let's get an x-ray. So I get some blood work. Generally looks okay, but this guy's got a kidney transplant. His creatinine's maybe 2.7. Baseline was 1.5, so it's going up.
And just for the listeners, that's an indication that kidney function could be worsening. Sometimes it can be a kidney injury. Sometimes it can be indicative of kidney failure. But that's what Dr. Toll was looking at and saying, oh, so, you know, maybe there's something going on here.
I get his chest x-ray and I look at it and there is, in the middle of the chest x-ray, is an area we call the mediastinum that we look at. and his mediastinum is a little bit wide, which any emergency physician gets a little bit concerned about. Again, talking about aneurysm or dissection, which is just badness in the chest. And I think, well, shoot, I need to scan this guy with a CT scan, but he's got a transplanted kidney and his creatinine, his kidney function is not good. So I decide I'm just going to scan him without any contrast to get a good indication of what's going on. In my head, I think if it's really that bad, I'll see it on a non-contrast CT scan. Get the non-con CT. The radiologist calls me and says, hey, can you do a contrast CT because I'm concerned about aneurysm and dissection? I said, listen, doc, I would love to get a contrast CT, but I'm in a predicament. This guy is a transplanted kidney, and if we give him the IV contrast, we might knock out his kidney. Contrast-induced nephropathy is a whole other conversation, but in this case, it is a concern. So he says, okay, then get a stat echo. Okay. And I said, well, I need to know if you're concerned enough. Do I need to be calling the CT surgeon? And he said, I don't know. I get a stat echo, which is actually pretty unbelievable. I had an echo tech come in to the ER. It was like 9 p.m. at night. They did an echo and it showed a concern for a flap, which meant that there was concern for dissection. So I called our CT surgeon at the hospital and he said, we don't do aneurysms and dissections here. You have to transfer this patient out. And I said, okay. So I called another local hospital. They said, oh, okay, this person's on call. Call that person. They said, oh, just kidding, we're not on call. So the local hospital didn't have anyone for CT surgery on call. Called another hospital. They looked at the imaging with me. They said, I'm not sure it's a dissection. You need to get IV contrast. And I gave them the whole issue of, this is a transplanted kidney. They said, well, it's either the kidney or the heart. And I said, no, but can you help me out here a little bit? We've got the echo. Like I said, well, it looks actually, even if it was a dissection, it's too complicated for me. So we can't even accept him. So I finally call my third hospital, get hold of a CT surgeon who agrees to accept him without IV contrast with the echo images and the CT images. He looked at both of them and he said, I mean, it's pretty complicated, but I think I can take care of this guy. And so let's get him transferred over there. So I get the whole transfer process started. This is just going back to my least favorite part of emergency medicine. His insurance denied the transfer.
Oh my gosh. Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not even kidding you. They called and said, we're really sorry. We're declining the transfer because we should have been your first call. And so, I mean, that obviously made me very upset. This was like 5 hours after my shift had ended too, because I was just so wrapped up in this case. Anyway, it ended up working out where I talked to a bunch of people at the insurance company and I got them to okay the transfer process for this guy. He ended up having a dissection. It was a type A. He needed a repair. Unfortunately, he lost his kidneys, even though he didn't get the IV contrast.
Just like poor perfusion.
Yeah, just poor perfusion. I mean, these cases never go well in the long run. You know, there's a lot of hypoperfusion to the spinal cord, to the kidneys, to the gut, those kinds of things. So it's pretty common for them not to do that well after. Anyway, he was on the list for a transplanted kidney again. So, but he was doing well 2 months post-op, just getting dialysis.
All things considered, that's a pretty good outcome. So I also should say, when we're talking about aortic dissection, it basically means when some layers of the aorta, which is that blood vessel that's sort of the main blood vessel coming out of the heart, a few layers separate out and sort of impede flow of blood in the aorta. And that can lead to decreased blood flow to other parts of the body. So when we say poor perfusion, we're meaning there's not enough blood getting to some of the other organs like the kidneys. So that's why the kidneys failed.
That was a very memorable case for a couple reasons. One is when your spidey senses go off in emergency medicine and someone says chest pain radiating to the back, you take it very seriously. The second learning point is, as an emergency physician, you're going to have to choose one organ system over the other. So really prioritizing. In my head, I really didn't want this guy to lose his kidney because I didn't want to be responsible for giving him contrast or doing whatever so that he would lose his kidney. But at the same time, I knew something had to be done because if he lost his aorta, that would be a bigger deal. So I felt like that was a huge learning point for me in the beginning of being an attending and just figuring out everything is a risk benefit. Every procedure, every scan, every lab you do is risk benefit. And trying to figure out the least amount of risk with the most amount of benefit is something that you will only learn with time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we face these challenges fairly regularly in the emergency department. And often I'll try to talk to the patients about it if it's not sort of like a life-threatening immediate situation and say, you know, these are the risks, these are the benefits. Do you have a preference on, you know, what choice we make? But I mean, in the era of COVID, I think there's been even more of that sort of risk versus benefit decision-making. So what has been the most difficult thing for you as a physician during the pandemic, speaking of COVID?
So COVID was, still is, something that has contributed to my emotional exhaustion and burnout. And that has been the most difficult thing for me. I think part of the emotional exhaustion and burnout was mostly just because we were surrounded by so much unknown and so much death. And as ER physicians, I don't want to say we're used to death, but we know how to handle it. We can handle loss much better than other people can.
We're trained to handle loss.
But we're not trained to handle mass casualty loss. And I'm not saying that COVID came in as a mass casualty, but at certain points in the pandemic, it felt like it. Especially when we were, at least in Los Angeles, in our surges, when we had so many patients that we weren't accepting EMS transfers for cardiac arrest patients. That is something that haunts me because the amount of times that I had to call a death over the radio because they couldn't transfer the cardiac arrest patient, it's not ideal because why did I go into this? I went into this because I always want to be able to do something. And the first time in years, you feel hopeless and helpless.
You hit the key point by saying helpless, because that's something that I think most emergency medicine physicians and doctors in general don't like to feel helpless. And we went into medicine so that we could make a difference. And so when there's just that much mortality and that much morbidity, and there's just so much that's out of your control, you feel helpless. And I think that really affects mental health.
I would be lying if I said my mental health was super strong for the entire pandemic. What people don't understand, or at least they don't understand firsthand, they think they may understand, is the emotional toll that that took on us. Because we were seen as soldiers, you know, we should be able to just continue our job, keep going, march on. But you can't when you feel like you're just overrun.
There are a lot of times where I remember losing a patient. And then, you know, you've been in a room with that patient trying to save them for over an hour in most cases. And then the second, you know, you call that patient or lose that patient, you have to turn around and run back to all of your other patients immediately because you haven't been able to do anything for them and the entire time you were in the room with that patient. And so then, you know, you have all of these other patients who are angry with you because you haven't done anything for them over the last hour. And there's no time to really process mentally, emotionally, the loss of the patient that you had. And I think you can maybe handle that, or I don't mean to say you, I think any one of us can handle that every once in a while, but when it's happening multiple times a shift, or just when the frequency of that happening is so much that you never have the time to process. And it definitely takes a toll.
We've all been pushing the ability to process and just been pushing. And it's come to a breaking point, and you'll see it now in hospitals where it's not just physicians, it's all staff who have, push it aside, keep going, because we don't have time to process. And now people are getting to the point where they're so burned out and they're running on fumes emotionally that people are leaving. They're either taking a medical leave of absence or completely changing careers, which is just terrible and sad.
Especially after everything that you have to go through to become a physician, leaving the field is not something that anyone takes lightly. And so the fact that so many people are leaving suggests that we really need to do more to look at mental health and how to better help all clinicians cope.
Part of being a physician too is that we feel like we always know what's right. I mean, as physicians, we are the worst patients. And so you can say to yourself, okay, yes, I'm anxious and I'm sad and I have a lot on my plate. Oh, but I'm not suicidal. I'm not homicidal. I'm not having auditory and visual hallucinations. So therefore, I don't need to get professional help just yet. And people can, because we know what to look for, we can reason our way around it.
We so often view everything through the lens of, is this admittable? So no, then I guess I don't need any medical help. It's like the lens of the emergency medicine physician is so different than I think many, many people. What do you think has been the most difficult thing for your patients during the pandemic?
I've noticed is access to care. In the beginning, all the offices were closed, so nobody was getting the preventative care they needed. They weren't getting the medication refills, the blood glucose checks, the blood pressure checks. And then offices were starting to open, but people were still too scared to go to the doctor. And now I feel like it's kind of swung even more the other way, where people are so backlogged in primary care that people aren't able to get in. So they're saying, I can't get an appointment for 3 months. So then they kind of become complacent. So that access to care has been a huge detriment to all patients. I had one woman who had a hernia, a ventral hernia, that popped out in the beginning of COVID. She never saw a physician for it. I saw her 2 weeks ago. It had never been reduced, which meant that she had never pushed the hernia back in. And it became strangulated, which basically means that it loses its blood flow and becomes a surgical emergency. And I thought to myself, if she had gone to her physician in the beginning of COVID with a ventral hernia that was causing symptoms, she could have gotten a preventative surgery, gotten a mesh, prevented that from happening. But thus, it did not happen.
I've seen a couple of cases of cancer as well, where people were just kind of like, I didn't want to get checked because I was worried about COVID, or I couldn't get an appointment, or any number of reasons. And, you know, by the time I see them, they're experiencing significant symptoms and disease has advanced a lot more than it would have if they'd gone early, which was their initial inclination. again, that's really hard to deal with sometimes when you see those cases and you're just like, gosh, I wish I'd just been there sooner. I wish there was more I could have done. Not liking being helpless. What is one thing you wish everyone knew about COVID-19?
One thing I wish everyone knew about COVID, I wrote something else down, but I want to say this, is that the emotional roller coaster that it's taken on all physicians, where we went from being heroes to people were clapping outside their windows and cheering for us at 8 p.m. to severe turmoil and anguish at work and trying to figure out how to handle all these patients, to then dealing with anger, the community, about how we're handling the pandemic and vaccines, et cetera, to now burnout. So you can imagine that anybody who's gone through all of those emotions within the past 2 years, we're not going to be on our best. We're trying.
That's something that I've really struggled with too, is just the anger sometimes, like toward the medical community and toward science. What is one thing you wish you knew earlier in the pandemic?
Every ER physician is going to say the same thing, that I wish we knew how to treat it earlier. Now, not necessarily, you know, the monoclonal antibodies and the inhaled budesonide and the corticosteroids. No, more just the simple act of when and when not to intubate. Because we were intubating hypoxic patients as soon as they hit the door because we thought that that was right. And I will never forget looking at these patients thinking, they're talking to me. I mean, they don't look great, but they don't look like they're on death's doorstep with a low oxygen to 70%. But I am supposed to intubate them, so that's what I do. And that's one thing that I wish we had known earlier, was that we weren't supposed to intubate them, because I think that that would have taken out a lot of anxiety in the beginning, knowing that supplemental oxygen with the nasal cannula and the BiPAP machine were good enough.
We actually were pushed away from BiPAP for a while because the concern for aerosols. And I think that's one of my biggest regrets, is I wish as a medical community, we could have maintained the use of BiPAP earlier for these patients. Because again, like you said, we know now that intubating, unless somebody is imminently going into like a respiratory arrest or something, we're intubating too early on in the pandemic. And so I think BiPAP would have been a great way to avoid that in a lot of patients. But we were very worried about the aerosols, and probably rightly so. I mean, it does generate aerosols. And so that kind of goes back to our risk versus benefit conversation, where you're trying to balance all of these risks and all of these benefits for the patients, for the nurses, for the x-ray techs, for the physicians, for everybody in the hospital, as well as the other patients next door. It's difficult to know what the right choice is. And I think in a lot of those cases, there's not necessarily a right choice. It's a learn.
We were doing the best we could with the information we had. It's just frustrating. And hindsight is always 20/20. But it's just something I always think about now when I see a hypoxic patient and I put them on BiPAP and I think, a year ago, I would have intubated this patient.
It's funny too, because I look at my O2 sats when I climb mountains, and there are some times where I'm like, oh, I'm at a nice 70%. If I saw myself in the ER right now, I would intubate me, but I'm fine. So it's funny how perspective sort of changes. What is one lesson you think we can take from this pandemic to prepare for future outbreaks and pandemics?
This is the lesson that I would like everyone to learn, is that early vaccination rates are really the best thing to prevent the spread of any disease. We can look at history and look at polio and measles and say the same thing about those vaccines. Early vaccination would not only prevent the spread, but it would prevent the spread, which would cause further mutations of the disease, the virus, that would then cause new variants of interest and variants of concern. I wish that people will learn for the future, that in 100 years, when there's another pandemic, that there's one way out of it. And if you do it right, it will work.
And that one way being vaccination.
Yes.
We're recording this on December 2nd, and the Omicron variant has been a topic of conversation recently and a variant of concern. So we don't know a lot about Omicron yet, but scientists all over the world are working on that. And so let's kind of talk a little bit about why Omicron exists and how herd immunity will help prevent future variants. And you just sort of talked about this, but I really want to make sure that we're clear.
Let's talk about the variants for a quick second. So everyone was aware of Delta being the major variant of concern. Let's just define variant of interest and variant of concern. So when there's a virus that has a certain sequence, and when some of the genes change, it becomes a variant of that virus. Now, when the genes change, it could go one way or the other. It could become more severe, it could become more transmissible, or it could just completely fail. So with variants of interest, that means that we've identified that there's been variations in the virus that we are looking at. But when we have a variant of concern, what we see are true mutations in that virus that are making it so that it is concerning for higher transmission rates or increased severity of disease. With Delta, we knew that it was much more transmissible. It was more highly transmissible than our original SARS-CoV-2. With Omicron, we don't have the information just yet as to the transmissibility and the severity. What we do know with the little info is that it seems to be spreading rapidly. But one thing that seems to be coming out of South Africa is that despite it being highly transmissible, the vaccines still do seem to be working to protect us against the severe disease, hospitalizations, ICU stay, and death. Using these vaccines, if we are all vaccinated, we would prevent further mutations from happening because we couldn't spread the virus and it couldn't change its gene sequence and become more transmissible and more severe.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I really want to emphasize, because the mutations only happen when the virus is able to replicate. So if we stop the virus from replicating by stopping the virus from infecting new people, then those mutations can never happen. So the more people who are vaccinated, the less spread there is, the less reproduction of the virus, the less chance a mutation happens. And so therefore, the pandemic ends and we can go back to the old normal.
Which is light years away at this point.
Yes, yes, unfortunately.
Obviously, there's still a lot for us to learn. And we thought there was still a lot for us to learn with the Delta variant as well. But I think if we can just emphasize one thing, is that vaccines do work. And despite having these mutations, the vaccines are still saving people. And we as a society can move forward if we all get vaccinated.
So we are right in the middle of the holidays now. And so do you have any advice on how people can stay safe over the holidays with family gatherings again?
Take a page out of our books from last year, I think would be a really good idea for everybody. I mean, masking works. We know it works. But just purely being outside is helpful as well. If you have family members that you're concerned about that aren't vaccinated, I would recommend that they get vaccinated. If you have family members who are vaccinated but are immunocompromised, such as cancer patients, people who are undergoing chemotherapy, severe diabetes, pregnancy, those kinds of things, I would highly recommend that you get tested before you see your friends and family that you're concerned about. You can do antigen tests, which obviously are not as sensitive as PCR tests, but they are helpful to know whether or not you're going to be contagious at that time. These at-home tests are widely available now, and I think not 100%, but it's better than nothing.
Absolutely. I love using them. I think there's like a lot of peace of mind that you can gain from just having a quick test. And then obviously, if you're having symptoms, you should back that up with a PCR test. But
if you're having symptoms, back it up with a PCR. And you know what? Honestly, if you're having symptoms, it's okay to sit out of a family dinner and just stay away. Wear your mask, be outside. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Especially, I mean, if you're feeling sick and any concern for COVID, the recommendation at this time is to not go to those family gatherings and not be around other people for sure. But I love all of the advice that you had, Dr. Toll, in continuing to wear masks and eating, gathering outside if possible. We live in Southern California, so I guess it's easy for us to say that, not so easy for some other people in the rest of the country. But if you can, outside is always safest. And then doing the pre-testing and the post-testing if you do have a family gathering.
Yeah, you know, one other thing is you just don't want to be responsible for a super spreader event. So if you're having a gathering, just make sure that everyone knows and understands the risks and make sure that everyone's on the same page.
Well, thank you so much for all of that wonderful advice and for sharing all of your experiences. Do you have any final thoughts or advice before we wrap this up?
Get vaccinated. If you have any friends who are in healthcare, make sure you give them a hug. It's been a tough year and a half, 2 years. Obviously, make sure you have your mask on, but give someone that you know who's in healthcare a big hug. They need it. They deserve it.
I'm sending a hug to you now. That's it for this episode. If you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating, subscribe, or send this episode to someone you know who might enjoy it. Feel free to connect with us on our website, theemergencydocs.com, or Instagram at theemergencydocs. Until next time.
Bye. We'll be right back.